Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, gather around once again around that iPad and get your speakers hooked up and get Grandma out of the bedroom so that you can all gather around as a family and listen to the wisdom of Dr. Drew and Bob Forrest This Life.
Hey, welcome everybody. We got great guests today. Also, thank you for telling a friend. We appreciate it. We love your feedback. Email at drdrew.com/contact. You'll get on that weekly email list. We've got that huge opioid series I want you guys all to partake of.
Of which Suboxone is a huge component.
We're actually working on the Suboxone chapter. It's taking a lot longer than we thought.
No kidding.
It's requiring investigative journalism. emails. We read as many as we can. We don't respond to them on the website, but we try to get to them on the show. And don't forget about the Amazon banner. Please click through there. Hydrolite, you'll save 30% if you use Drew18 as a code. Bergamet, of course, 25% discount. Drew at discount. Drew at checkout. Bergamet is that natural statin that I advocate, and Hydrolite, of course, is the best hydration product there is. Bob uses
I use it 24 hours.
He rips it off and uses it all day long. I'm going to be distributing it all over the Drunk History set.
Cure me and lead me to live to be 88 years old.
All right, and we have great guests today. A friend, Jason Waller, at Waller Jason, is Twitter
like
at Jason Waller.
Like JasonWaller.com.
Jason,
how you doing, brother?
Hey, man, good
like
to see you.
Like the prodigal son has come home.
I'm home. Let me in.
I'm going to let you guys both tell your own stories. And you brought with you Pete Cropsey at First Love Church on Facebook, First Love Church, Costa Mesa, California. Book is Dead Man Waking. Pete, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here.
So, his mom has been saying he needs to be here for many
years. That's right.
Years.
My mom's glued right now.
Founded and operates Coastal Recovery LLC, treatment centers around Southern California. First Love Church in Costa Mesa. That's where he is founder and senior pastor currently.
Yes, that's correct.
Who's going to tell their story?
It's a recovery church.
Who's going to tell their story first?
Well, I want to hear a little bit of Pete's story.
Yeah, of course you do, because we want to know what the hell you've been doing for 2 years. Pete, go.
Oh, my God.
Okay, so I'm Pastor Pete Cropsey, and I am the senior pastor, founding pastor of First Love Church in Costa Mesa. You know, it's, let's see, I got sober after 25-plus years of prison, heroin, gang life, all of it, and it left me dead man, right? So thus dead man waking, because when I got sober, I walked into a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and for the first time in my life, I felt home. You know, I always felt home in prison. I always felt home in institutions, and I would get out here on the street, and I would be like, I have no idea how to conduct myself. I have no idea how to live life. I don't know how to go into the supermarket and cash a payroll check. I mean, I cashed plenty of checks. None of them were ever mine. But, I didn't know how to exist in the world, and I was comfortable in prison, so I was very much institutionalized. And September 3rd, 1989, I fell into a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and I was warned at the door. I was warned. This little guy, and I mean, at the time, I was like 265 pounds and freshly paroled, and this little guy comes up to me, and he's like, I'm the manager of this Solano Club, and I don't really appreciate you convicts coming around here and stealing the newcomer girls and going back to prison, and you don't care, but if you want to save your life, because you are dying, and when he said that, I'm not dying, I'm 270 pounds, I could rip your head off, you know, and he said, you are dying, but if you want to live, you'll go into that meeting, and you'll listen for the similarities and not the differences. And
is that the Costa Mesa Annex
yes,
Clubhouse?
Uh-huh, yeah, it
saved,
is.
Saved hundreds of thousands of lives, I would say.
That's wow. Right, man.
Do you know who the guy was at the door?
There's a lot of little guys that love doing that to big guys.
This guy's name was Dave Regal. He ended up being my sponsor for 15 years. But some of the cohorts that ran around there.
NA is a little different than AA, Drew.
Oh, no, I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Well, some of Bob's friends were down there, Mike Ness and Gabby from the Cadillac Tramps and Mike Roach from TSOL and all those guys I got to be friends with. And they kind of saved my life because they pulled me into doing stage security for them. I had no idea what punk rock was. I really didn't.
Oh, my God.
No, I had no idea. And then I found out, you know, punk rock is a place where a big tattooed guy from prison can fit in really well.
Yeah.
You know? So,
you got the chain wallet.
Got the chain wallet. But so anyway, you know, I went to that meeting and he told me, he said, look for the similarities, not the differences. And I heard that. And when I went in, because I would have gone in there with an attitude like, I probably spilled more dope than you ever did. or what are those tattoos? Decals? You didn't earn those. I would have had that kind of, you know.
Yeah, yeah, different.
But the thing is, I was so busy promoting myself being this big tough guy, but it was all about covering up my fear and hiding behind an image that I created for myself that wasn't the real me. Yeah. Because I'm that guy that cries over Little House on the Prairie, mm-hmm. really. You know what I mean? I'd spend all day on the prison yard posting up like a tough guy, and then I'd weep into my pillow at night in my cell. You know, like, what's wrong with my life?
But so, everybody from that world kind of knows that's what's going on. I just happened to counsel an old gangster this last 3 months, and so I'm back in that world. He knew it. Mm-hmm. He's like 55 years old, going through what you're going through.
He knew he was ten. He knew he was tender on the inside.
Everybody knows that there's weakness on. It's a matter of intimidating. I don't know what it is, but it's singular in its mentality.
It is totally singular in its mentality. Even though inside there's this strong desire for a tribal relationships, you know what I mean? Which is what I found in Narcotics Anonymous. But what happened for me is, you know, I mean, I grew up in Laurel Canyon, and my dad was a hippie, and he was in the music business, and I grew up around that whole environment. He was also a nudist, and so I grew up coming home from school.
His favorite era. He hates that era so much.
It screwed up so many people.
It really did. Yeah. But, you know, it was totally a blessing, on the one hand, to be experiencing the culture of the 60s. Yeah. You know, it was really great, but it did almost kill me. You know, I would come home from school, and there'd be people naked in the living room smoking weed, and I'm 10 years old, you know.
Mom might have been there.
She might have, right? I tell people, you know, that we grow up trained by the world, and the world is a bad teacher.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, you look at the moral depravity that we face in this country today, and it's pretty astounding, really. So I'm there, and I'm in the program, and I'm giving it all I've got. And
how did you go from Laurel Canyon to gangs?
Oh, well, you got to get Dead Man Waking. It tells the whole story. So okay. Dead Man Waking will tell the whole story. It's a long story. It involves Puerto Vallarta growing up also in Laguna Beach, California, during the Brotherhood of Eternal Love era, and got to experience all that. And it was all really great. But there was this guy named Max Jeunesse, and he kind of reminded me of Bob. He was like the coolest cat there ever was. He had this 1950 Chevy that was slammed on the ground, so black it looked blue almost, and he always wore a black leather trench coat, and he had the Murder One shades and the crisp white t-shirt and the tattoos from his fingernails up to his earlobes, and he always had some dark, sexy-looking teenage girl on his arm. And I'm like, I want to be that guy, and he was a heroin dealer. And I started running errands for him, and then I was at this... making this delivery, and this guy swayed, Danny DiPaolo. He's like, hey, you ever done this? I'm like, no. He goes, you want to? And I'm like, absolutely, immediately, right now. You know, I
mean, how old were you?
I was 12.
There you go.
And when were you running the stuff for him? At 10, 12 also?
I'm sorry, what?
When you started working with him when he was dealing.
Yeah, when I was 12.
Reminds me of Heidi Fleiss and her preoccupation with that lady that converted her. Remember?
Well, yeah, but there's a lot of this. You're right in that the 60s and 70s were this most permissive era. Right?
Dangerous for kids and families.
So I'm counseling a young woman now, and I know her dad very well, and I know his story. And I had heard him tell her it just a couple weeks ago. Started smoking pot with his dad at 9.
Mm-hmm.
Started doing coke at 12. Mm-hmm. His dad told him coke would clear his head.
I did a meeting with Danny Trejo last night. His uncle got him high at 8. Shooting heroin at 12.
Yeah.
Yeah. My 11. Dad took me to see 2001 Space Odyssey on LSD when I was 10, mm-hmm. you know.
So and then there was a doomed generation.
At the entryway in this building, there's the Peter Fonda, Dennis Hopper poster, the Easy Rider. I grew up believing every bit of that. But here's the thing, here was the real kicker, was that drug use in the mid-60s through the early 70s was all in the name of a spiritual seeking. We had. That's why it was okay for kids to get stoned with their parents.
But it was also about
healing trauma.
Well, it was sort of grandiose narcissism and almost culty sex activity. Like the men were, you know, indoctrinating all these young women. Like you said, there was a teenage girl on the guy's arm.
But most of the people involved in that lifestyle wouldn't have known what you meant when you said narcissist.
Yeah, you probably bumped into. My mom lived on Stanley Hill or whatever in Laurel Canyon with Mama Cass.
Okay.
And Manson was over at their house with Dennis Wilson. You were probably around that.
I was around then.
Everybody takes Manson and goes, this horrible bad guy. No, that was like common shit that was going
That's
on.
That's right. I agree. And to me, it has got to be some sort of a reaction to the Second World War. Something. Because it was like 15 years later and ba-boom. And it just was such an unusual reaction.
Yeah.
It's got to be something like that historically.
So then I don't mind, I hope you don't mind if I speak to this because I've seen a lot of it. The idea is to go as far away from that crazy way that your dad thinks into this ritualistic tribalism, you know, gangs kind of mentality. Mm-hmm. Because I bet you as you were going to that, you and your dad had some conversations where he's thinking you're losing your mind.
Well, what I remember most about that whole cultivation of this macho,
because that's antithesis of what your dad was, I imagine.
Yeah, pretty much. But what happened was, I lived in Puerto Vallarta for a number of years with my mother, and she was a clothes designer, and I was the only white kid in the entire city, and we moved there when I was 7. And I met a man who groomed me for molestation. And he was giving me everything that I needed as a kid with no dad. He was teaching me spearfishing, bow hunting, horsemanship, teaching me how to sail single-handed boats. And he groomed me, and we were on a hunting trip up into the jungle, a bow hunting trip on horseback. I mean, okay, I'm like a little over 8 years old. What 8-year-old kid is not going to want to go bow hunting on horseback in a jungle, right?
Right.
So he set me up perfectly.
What mom's going to let that happen, though?
Well, my mom was very busy.
Every mom from the 60s.
That's my point.
Yeah, so the thing was that my parents, I became the invisible kid at like 4 years old because my parents were both so consumed with what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I was also, I talked to my mom recently. She goes, you know, I know that you think that, you know, you were abandoned, but you weren't having any parenting. You know what I mean? And I understand that I was completely ADD, ADHD.
No kid is having any parenting.
Right.
Is Elvis having any parenting?
No.
So I met this guy, Chewy, and he abused me for a couple of years. And it got, you know, at first it was a compromise. It's like, okay, so I'm not willing to give up what I'm getting from him, so as long as he doesn't hurt me, I'll participate.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But eventually it did become more intrusive, more invasive. Mm-hmm. It became painful, it became violent, and then it got to the threats against my family and against my own life, and so, you know, I got snatched out of there.
Imagine an 8-year-old little mind dealing with that.
It's unbelievable.
It's a miracle you're sitting here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, God had a plan. There's no question in my mind about that, because, you know, so I got back to L.A., and we were on our way to a nudist camp for a weekend.
And just smoking regular, weed just in the car. Regular weekend for yeah. beating his dad.
And my little friend Johnny Weber, I flipped him off in the backseat of the car, and my dad, this little square back VW, and he caught me in the ribby rib. He goes, you don't even know what that means. And I said, yes, I do. It means when somebody, you know, and I described a homosexual experience of molestation, and my dad pulled the car over, threw the roach out the window, and, you know, proceeded to, like, and I got the silent treatment for the entire weekend. We came home to our little house on Lookout Mountain Road that Sunday, and that Sunday night after bedtime, he came into my room, and he called me a queer and beat me up and spit in my face.
Oh, my God.
That's where
the whole need to be this big, tough guy was born, that night, you know? And that night I decided that I was going to be the most heterosexual, the toughest, the meanest. Mm-hmm. Don't look at me twice. And,
well, he accomplished what he wanted to.
Well, I don't know. But I realized many years later that what had happened was that he was sent away to private school when he was like 8 years old and stayed all the way. And he had experienced the same thing and never been able to deal with or process that experience. And so his rage was not at me. His rage was at events that
his perpetrator.
Right.
Well,
right.
Also his inability to protect you away from what happened to him.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm sure.
Sheesh.
But when you're stoned on pot, it's a little, and nude, it's a little hard.
God.
When are people going to realize that they are the representative protecting their child?
They're representative of society. They're
it's
the
crazy.
Entirety. Yeah, that was a horrible period of history. I'm on the record with that.
You're playing into his wheel well right now.
Okay, well, that's good, I guess, right?
So well, I think it got worse in the 70s. I think, you know.
No, I think it did, because then the seductive nature of the justification of a spiritual seeking became reality, because then all of a sudden methamphetamine and intravenously ingested drugs.
And teenagers picked up the crucible.
Right.
The adults never contemplated the teenagers would behave like this. They're teenagers.
Right.
They just took right over.
Yeah.
I was a part of that.
Yeah, me too.
Right.
And it was not good.
It was fun for a while.
It's not healthy. It was not good. So anyway, so now you're pastor.
Yeah. So after my experience with my doesn't that seem like just the perfect natural transition? So having grown up in a household, because my dad was also an Eastern mystic, and if you've been around L.A. for a number of time, any length of time through the 60s, you remember a thing called Subud and Latihan, which was a spiritual seeking kind of group that was established here in Hollywood in West L.A. And
you were probably around the Source family.
I was
right. time.
I was. That's right.
Dude,
and
cultural help, history of L.A. Colts,
right here. Yeah.
Help create love, which manifests peace on Fairfax and 3rd Street. I used to work in their graveyard shift when I was a little kid.
Wow.
But so you know, this coming out of that whole molestation thing and coming back to L.A. and living with my dad and then going through this whole thing where I purposely set out to cultivate a tough guy attitude and a tough guy persona. I couldn't wait to get to jail. I couldn't, you know, I loved juvenile hall. It was like, now I'm with the homies, right? I'm a tough guy. And so when I finally got out of all that and I was a member of that Vagos Motorcycle Club for over 20 years and became the top dog in that whole deal. And when I finally got sober, I had already had this spiritual experience of having grown up around guys who were reading the Bhagavad Gita and Baba Ram Dass Be Here Now and the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and I had already experienced all of that kind of spirituality, right? And when I got to the program, you know, I had the opportunity to create a God of my own understanding, and the problem was is that the God of my own understanding was way too permissive, you know.
Abstract.
Because I'm just so permissive with myself, you know what I mean? And I got to create, I remember in a movie.
You shouldn't be trusted to create your own God.
Right, exactly, exactly. So, and I remember, you know, I would see guys in prison carrying a Bible around and I'd be like, you're such a sissy. Because I knew they were hiding behind that. And that was probably a wrong judgment to make, but I did. And you know, maybe they were
sincere.
I believe
it's real when it's happening.
Right.
And it needs to be encouraged post parole, and it's not that the
spiritual
parole
life?
Office doesn't even want to talk about it.
No,
that people become devout in prison, and I believe I've been into the prisons and done
and
12-step stuff. It's real.
But
their inability to transition that into the real world,
right.
Like to get hooked
pretty
up
simple.
With a church,
hook up to a church or
parole.
Pete.
Parole is secular. Parole doesn't even address it.
Yeah. Maybe it can't. Maybe there's a law against it.
No problem.
You know,
if there isn't, they're going to hear
and
this,
state.
And they're going to make one.
Yeah.
But you know, so you know, I would get out of prison and I would go to Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. Pastor Chuck Smith, the founder of that movement,
and
I would go there and I would hear what I thought was the truth. I knew was the truth, but I would feel disqualified. I would feel like, if these people knew what was really going on in my head, they'd want me in a different zip code, you know. And
what years were you going there?
This was in the all through the late 70s.
Yeah, I was there in 78 and 79.
Yeah, Odin Fong and
all
those guys.
Tony, this guy got me into that.
Yeah, so it was great. It was great.
He was great. Is he still alive?
I don't think so.
Yeah, he was great, this guy Chuck. That was before
Pastor Chuck. No, Pastor Chuck passed from lung cancer after never having smoked a cigarette in his life like 5 or 6 years ago.
Mm. Oh, okay.
And
that's
what I'm saying. He preached the day before he died.
And he was a guy, this is before politics got sewn to religion.
Yeah.
He was just about Jesus and about love and kindness, and it was a powerful message. And then it got railroaded by politics.
Yeah, so I would hear him and I would believe him and I would know that it was true, but I would feel disqualified. And so in that September 3rd, 1989, when I fell into the Narcotics Anonymous meeting, I learned integrity. And that was the thing about this little teeny guy who was jacking me up at the door. I would have never taken that kind of crap from somebody. You know what I mean? Except for he had something that I couldn't quite identify that was authoritative and very powerful. And it turned out what that thing was integrity. And that was the first time I'd come face to face with a man of integrity. And it was very impressive to me, you know.
How do you define integrity?
Wow. Okay. So that's thrown a curve at me. I would define integrity as someone who means what they say and say what they mean, and someone who lives a life that's above reproach, that doesn't do anything in the dark that couldn't be brought into the light. You know, and someone who's right-sized.
So living what they say and being right-sized.
Right.
Yeah.
We were talking about that in a prior episode where, you know, this idea that your mouth lines up with your actions, right? This applies in marriage and family therapy,
right.
And in all areas. And we've just gotten so far away from that. We're allowing whatever you say is just what you say.
Well, that's,
you know,
relativism.
Moral relativism.
Yeah.
Trump's kind of an example of moral relativism. Anything you say, like, just line up what you say is what you do and what you do is what you say. In the last episode, we had the guy from Fox here, Greg. Right? Fascinating guy, Greg. What's his last name?
Gutfeld.
He's on The Five. You ever watch his show on Fox? Anyways, we were talking about how I believe Paul Ryan is just pushed out completely here because what he's saying isn't what he believes. Right, Drew?
Yeah.
No, so it's in our politics we can spot hypocrisy.
Right.
In our church often with Jim Baker and Kenneth Copeland and some of these people, you can spot the hypocrisy. But in the 12-step world, it's really hard to be a hypocrite. Because everybody spots it and everybody confronts it.
Right, you spot it, you got it too, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's the extraordinary
part. So
I think,
you know, pure part of AA in the 12-step world is there's no way to bullshit your way through it.
Right, there's a deep sensitivity to bullshit. Deep sensitivity.
Well, that leads into the whole Suboxone controversy. because if a person is put on Suboxone maintenance and they're professing that now I'm clean, how do they relate to the tribal nature of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous?
Because it's weird.
You can't take chips. You can't, you know. And
no,
these
they
people
do,
are,
though.
I know,
the doctors tell them to. We were just doing over this article. They're now putting people who are not addicted to opiates on Suboxone as a craving medication. Putting them on an opiate stop their cravings.
And in the literature, in the medical literature, why they've selected...
New York Times, baby.
Bob, listen to this. Why they've selected, in the original literature, why they've selected Suboxone and not Naltrexone is because Suboxone is so reinforcing.
Better.
Yeah.
They like it better.
I do.
Of course you do. All you guys do.
I do indeed.
Yeah.
Because it's like you're kind of high.
Opiate. Yes, you get high.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got opiates at it. And for you family members at home, understand there is a drug called Naltrexone that does all the things that the doctor is telling you need to have happen
and that
in
doesn't
your
get
loved
you
one.
High.
And it's not addictive.
Yeah.
But they sewed the two together and now say the one is better. Yeah. Because it's got opiates in it. Of course it's better.
Well, they perfected the same machinations that they attempted all through the 70s with methadone. And
right.
Now they perfected it with Suboxone. It's a method of control, is it really, at the bottom line. But, so that guy, he had this integrity. And I wanted that integrity. So I dove into that program. And, we used to have a saying around the Costa Mesa Club of work the steps or die, MF-er. You know, and that was what was happening. It was about working the steps. It was about being of service. It was about being involved in H&I.
What if I remember, work the steps or die? We used to say that.
Yeah, it's not popular anymore.
No.
You should adopt that in your don't die policy.
The don't die policy is
right.
Very simple.
But, you know, I heard that.
Yeah.
And I took it to heart. And it was very tribal. I mean, we had all these punk rock bands and was going to gigs and doing shows, but we were together in everything we did. You know, the
community.
Meeting, the 4:30 NA meeting at the Costa Mesa Club was like a tribal gathering every day, you know.
Right.
And, I loved that. But what started to happen for me is I started to recognize the relativism in the God of your own understanding thing. And I had a conflict with that because I had heard of Jesus and I did believe that the word of God was authoritative and infallible and inerrant. And now that I understood that I wasn't disqualified, I was in a hurry to get back to that life. And
It was a bridge to where you needed to go.
But God made it clear to me, you're not to leave the 12-step programs, because what happens is a lot of people who find their way into Christianity, they abandon the program. And you know, you've got things like, you know, you've got all these other methods that incorporate Christianity and recovery. And from my position, it's like, okay, so if I'm a Christian in recovery, where am I supposed to be? If I'm listening to Matthew 28, it says, go ye therefore into all the world and make disciples of all men and baptize them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Where should I be positioning myself as a recovering addict and a Christian? I should be positioning myself in secular Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous and gently massaging the word of Christ into the meeting without violating traditions.
Example.
And so what happens is now I have this church in Costa Mesa, First Love Church, and it's probably 95% people out of the rooms. And we celebrate AA birthdays there, and you know, and we give shout out to people that have accomplished different milestones in the program, and it's very cool.
We've been saying that we think there's more.
The religion needs to step up in our society. There's no doubt in my mind that we're lost. We're lost partially because the family is just so broken, the family systems in America. But systems that used to help families heal and stay together are broken.
Yeah.
Religion, social services. But I don't want to go down a rabbit hole because I have a feeling you're here because this guy went off the rails.
Well, it's interesting because Jason's father and I served together at a church called Calvary Chapel Laguna Beach. We were deacons together at that church. I've known Jason's father for 30 years or 25 years, and so, you know, when God dropped Jason in my lap or dropped me in Jason's lap, we haven't figured out which yet. But you know, it was a very celebratory experience because I love this kid. You know what I mean?
Me too.
And I want to see only great things happen for him, and I know he's totally capable of great things. So I'm grateful to him for bringing me here today, for sure. Because I'm there's a little idolatry going on with me for you guys. You know what I mean?
Because gosh, come on now.
So that's really a cool thing. It's really cool.
I always felt I was going to the NA Costa Mesa. Well, I have a long history in Orange County. One is my high school English teacher took me to an AA meeting in Laguna. It was Chuck C's meeting when I was 17 years old.
What?
Because she caught me drinking Bacardi and Coke in class. What kind of fucking thing is that?
What's the big deal?
Right? At Marina High School in Huntington Beach. And I remember...
You were living in Huntington Beach?
Yeah, I went my last junior and senior year of high school there.
Jesus,
to get away from the bad elements of what was going on.
Did your whole family move to Huntington Beach?
Just me and my mom. My dad was dead. Right?
Yeah. Your mom or your sister mom?
My mom.
Wait,
okay.
What?
My grandma mom.
My mom.
It's complicated.
Is that like what we heard on the radio coming up here?
Yeah.
So.
Every time I talk to you, I learn something new. It's the weirdest damn thing.
Well, yeah. It was my here's the narrative. My dad was planning on killing himself. He wanted to get me to one of my sisters. It didn't matter if it was my sister mother or my other sister who lived in Huntington Beach. He knew that my mother couldn't take care of me by herself.
Got it.
So first we moved to San Jose to be near my sister mother. She didn't want me. She was like, you know, I'm 15 years old telling everybody to fuck off and you know what I mean? So then we moved. He died up in San Jose, by the way. And then we moved to Huntington Beach to be near my other sister, Susan, hoping that she could guide me.
So you were moving around all these different high schools, or was it a summer
thing? Yeah, high schools.
Oh, my gosh.
I went to 3 high schools.
That explains everything.
Yeah, it really does. It's antisocial personality disorder.
I opted out of the whole high school thing.
You're not as damaged as me.
I stole 10 pounds of Colombian, hopped on a plane, and lived on the North Shore of Kauai in a treehouse when I was supposed to be in high school. So.
That's like Chris Hoy or something. So, but I do believe that Jason I love like a little brother, and I didn't know how to stop what was happening. I knew it was happening. Not drinking or drugs or anything, just he needed something that I couldn't provide because my sobriety works for me.
Yeah.
Right? The people we were in business with had no sense of anything, right? And we were in this mess, and I just thought, it's going to play out the way it plays out, right? And then I know that you were a big part of how it played out this last year.
Yeah. And
what do you do when a friend of yours is believing a bunch of stuff that's not good for them? I'm not saying using or gambling or anything. Just the mindset drifts into a different space. We've all had people like that.
Well, okay, here's the thing. And, you know, you might not adhere to or subscribe to a scriptural commentary concerning the
state. I do the prodigal son.
concerning the state of the world, but the Bible makes it clear that this is a spiritual scenario. This whole life, everything in it, whether you're for God or against God, it all is a platform for a spiritual battle or a warfare that's going on. So as we look at our culture and we look at the way the world is operating, we see that it is in moral decay. I mean, you cannot deny that stuff that is completely unacceptable 20 years ago today is commonplace. And so if what was totally unacceptable 20 years ago is commonplace today, there's not much left that's not acceptable today. But what will it be like in another 20 years if that same rate of deterioration, moral deterioration, takes place? I mean, what are going to be...
We won't live here. It's been my decision.
Right. So if we're involved in this spiritual battle, then, you know, when you're dealing with people who have been, like as I said earlier in the program, we've been taught by the world and we've been taught poorly. The world is a bad teacher. And because the world is under the sway and control of, you know, I say Satan, you may say negativity, evil forces,
right,
whatever. But the world is under the control of a very negative spiritual presence. And so
right now
yeah, absolutely. And so the evidence of this is in the people's rejection of biblical truths and of Christ, when it seems like it's like a no-brainer to me that I look around the world and I see that it's a total wreck. And I look over here. But the problem is that the Christian community has also been inundated with perpetrators of nonsense and baloney and lies. And, and you know, when we were talking about what's integrity, and I feel like, well, integrity, you know, the world, I judge myself by my intentions and the world judges me by my actions. So now actions need to be the dictating force in how I conduct my life. And what are my actions going to represent? What are my actions going to? So when it comes questions like how can I influence someone like Jason, I can do that on a Sunday morning in a sermon, and God's given me a gift for that because of the background that I've had, the lifestyle that I've had, and then having the theology education that I've also had. He's turned that into a thing where people are like, oh, I get it now.
Right.
He's given me a gift to be able to put feet on the word.
So how do you address in your church one of the things? Have you seen the Pope movie?
No.
That guy's amazing.
Yeah.
I don't know what you feel about
current
him.
Pope?
The current Pope has this documentary where he just shares. They ask him questions, and he says answers that I can't believe he's not executed by the Vatican.
Huh.
Like, he talks about the poor and being of service to the poor constantly, the Gospels, Christ. And that's so contrary to
Absolutely.
Everything that the Catholic Church is. And what happened with evangelicalism is this sowing to political belief. I watched it happen in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up Catholic, went to Catholic school 8 years. I have wonderful aunties that are very devout, that I love and respected, and what it made Christ appealing. It made the Bible appealing. It became not appealing at all in the 1980s when it got sown to politics.
Was it money or politics or both?
Politics.
Yeah.
It was politics. And really, I'm ready for Roe v. Wade to be reversed. I don't care. Reverse it. If that's what's dividing this nation and politicizing Christ, then reverse the fucking law.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been saying that for 10 years. Liberals want to kill me. You know what I mean? If that's the one thing that's caused all of this.
I don't know what's caused all this. I'm not clear.
What do you think it is?
I think it's the decade that you were exposed to as a kid.
That was definitely transformational.
It was TNT, and we need to get it back. We need to get it back from after that. We have to find a way back.
Yeah, you know,
and
we got way too much
glorification of illness. People are sick, and we glorify it.
Well, I see what you're saying about the decade, because having had Aleister Crowley as a star.
Right.
In that era, well, right there, you got problems.
It's bass-ackward. The most sociopathic, the most disturbed becomes the most elevated. And that's like, who's the kid that the adolescents look after? The drug addicted, cutting, brooding. Didn't used to be. That's a new phenomenon in human behavior. That's something that's been since the 60s, that the most disturbed kid acting out in the most antisocial way is the one most elevated.
Well, and you know, the thing about it is the culture is largely a monkey-see, monkey-do proposition. So you've got Paul McCartney and George Harrison bringing the Maharishi into the country, and the next thing you know, within a week, everybody's wearing a Nehru shirt.
Right,
you
right.
Know, so
mask production, branding, media. But I just think that getting back to the basics, I think that a lot of pockets of our society are trying to get back to the basics. Sounds like what you're trying to do at your church. Back to love. Back to respect. Right? But we can't deny, and I love that you said, there's a lot of corruption in the church. There's a lot of there's nothing but corruption in the recovery business.
I know.
You know what I mean?
I know.
So the idea that we within our systems – the church, the recovery industry, call out the bad actors, right? And that's what I've been trying to do. Like, don't get your health care from a Google search.
Right.
Right? Somebody's paying $80,000 to be the thing that popped up.
You know, Bob, I had the opportunity to start a Christian program within a fairly large, say, 75-bed traditional treatment center, right? I got offered an opportunity to come there and create a Christian program,
mm-hmm.
and I was made the director of pastoral care. They just said, do whatever you want to do. Well, I didn't know what to do. So what I did was I had all the census brought together for a group meeting, and I told my story.
Right.
And I had a sign-up sheet. And I said, if you guys would like to meet with me, here's the sign-up sheet. Well, in that first night, that sign-up sheet was filled with 25 clients. And so then I thought, well, I'm going to start a Wednesday night Bible study here at the center. And it's all voluntary. You know, you're assigned to your MFT. You're assigned to these clinical protocols that you're supposed to adhere to in order for insurance to pay.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing like that was going on with what I did. It was all voluntary. So Wednesday night, I started seeing 85% of the census in attendance at the Bible study.
Right.
So then I started having them brought to the church, and we would have three of those big druggy buggies, the big ones, you know, the big Mercedes Sprinters or whatever they're.
Drew has luckily not worked in recovery for 10 years and never seen them. You know that they get driven around in those Mercedes Benz limousines.
Yes, I do.
You do know that?
I'm aware of it.
So I would have three or four of those filled with clients every Sunday. And then I'm writing a book. I'm currently writing a book. Yeah. Currently writing a book called Living Life 365 24/7. And it's a Christian daily devotional, like My Utmost for His Highest or like Daily Reflections for AA people. It's similar to that, only it's written from a Christian perspective by an addict, me. And so I started using those. I'm about 2/3 of the way done with the book. I think I've got about 225 of them written so far. And I want 365. But I started using those to do morning groups. And this is how I know that Jesus, my God, has a huge effect on people that are broken and desperate and searching and maybe have always felt uncomfortable in their own skin, maybe have never felt a part of anything, because I was getting 85% attendance, and I ended up seeing as many clients as my schedule would permit, 4 to 5 clients a day, 5 days a week, 85% participation in my Wednesday evening Bible studies.
So what happened? 35 to 40. Like it's a past tense.
It is a past tense.
Like,
and here's what's
happening.
I don't
like where this story is going.
Here's what's happening. Here's what's happening is, you know, you talked about the corruption in the recovery industry.
Yeah.
Well, when the insurance companies started paying 15 to 20% on our billable hours, as opposed to the 45 or 50% that we had been getting, it became unsustainable. And the company closed. And it was very unfortunate, because in the efforts by whoever they are to get rid of all the bad actors in the business, some of the good actors are paying,
right.
Which is really a terrible thing when you consider that over 67,000 people died of opiate addiction, overdoses, and so forth in 2016. I'm not even sure what the numbers for 2017 are, but I know that it was over 66,000 in 2016. You think, okay, there's a huge need, but the need is being crippled by people in the recovery industry that have no morals or scruples.
That's what he said.
Oh, yeah.
I agree too.
Yeah.
So, but the thing was that I discovered is that, like, even now, this company's been closed for 3 months. I still have 25 to 30 alumni from that program at my church every Sunday. Two of them serve as ushers. One of them sometimes sings in my band. They're there for setup and tear down, and it's a beautiful thing. So I know that this is truth, because it's self-evident, and the evidence is the participation of these kids.
So how did Jason play into all this? I want
to
know.
Well, Jason, I go to a Sunday night Pills Anonymous meeting.
And, speaking of pills.
Yeah, right? And pills, aren't they? Pills are so tidy.
Yes.
They're actually encouraged.
Just following what the doctor told you to do.
Yeah, and maybe a little
especially
extra.
Especially if you have ADHD. Imagine how debilitating ADHD is.
Adult ADHD.
If you throw in a little dyslexia where you read the prescriptions, all it says 1 every 4 hours, somehow you think it says 4 every 1 hour. Right? Yeah.
So
Jason and I ran into each other at a PA meeting on a Sunday night, and it's like, you know, I've always been attracted to him. He's always been attracted to me as a brotherhood kind of thing, and he's like, let's get together. So we started having a little lunch here and there and meeting, and I'm looking for something new to do right now, and so is Jason. So we've just been kind of hanging out and, you know, kind of brainstorming, you know, what could be our next move? Is there something that God has for us together in this next stage of our lives? So,
well, yeah, I think we reconnected after running into each other for multiple years and never really kind of making anything of it. And then we finally turned to connecting. There was a reason we kept running into each other. The signs were there, right? So, and I never thought I'd
win. I'm just shocked he was at a PA meeting myself, personally.
Yeah. Well, come on, man. I was hiding pills everywhere.
Any meeting.
Any meeting. Yeah, that's true.
My name was Rob.
Oh, man.
Help
me,
Drew.
I was there.
I watched it. Okay, tell your story, Jason. In the general way, so it's not too shaming.
Well, no. I mean, shit, dude. The shame was, it is what it is, and what happens, what happened. And, you know, I let that shame and guilt kill me for so long that
You're being real right now.
Yeah,
I know you.
I honestly, the biggest freedom I experienced was being able to come clean. And
who'd you come clean to? Your dad?
To everyone.
All at once?
Mm-hmm. My mom.
Was it like an Instagram blast?
Hey. It actually.
Hey, I've been lying for the last 3 years. I've been high the whole time.
isn't it good? Well, no. So what happened is I actually my wife knew what was going on, but I was in my drug-induced psychosis, if you will. And
the
baby
had to have had something to do with it.
There was a little bit of everything. So I think I'll start back, you know, three and a half years ago is things in my life were really good. I think when we reconnected, you guys got to see things that were going on, and I was in a very, very good place. But, you know, as good things come without boundaries and balance, I started to take on more things. And the more complacent I became, the more I stayed away from my program, the more I stopped connecting with the right people. You know, my foundation, my fellowship, and my service ended up becoming none. I started surrounding myself with the wrong type of people. But I think the complacency, let me actually retract that, is as I got busier, I then actually, instead of listening to my body saying slow down, I go, well, something's got to be wrong. I got to go to a therapist. And by going to a therapist, we ended up talking. We thought that it would be a good idea to take Adderall.
Yeah.
And I
knew it. I saw it. Oh. That's the first time I've heard it out of his mouth.
And I didn't realize a therapist, you know, I thought it was just a doctor.
No, then they get you a doctor.
I know. It's just
so
unbelievable, man.
And this is probably a therapist that presents him or herself as an addiction specialist.
So
right. Specializing in getting you addicted.
It makes me insane.
Well, that's the crazy thing is obviously taking.
Did you go back and talk to that person and set them straight so at least they don't do it to somebody else, please?
I haven't yet because mentally I'm just not in the place.
Okay, but I mean, they have got to understand that they cannot think that way.
Well, no, 100%. And I think that's.
Don't understand what they think grown adults have to focus on that's so important.
Drug addict in their room and they don't know how to deal with them, and he seduced her with his ideas about how great it would be if he could concentrate.
Oh, it was phenomenal. So, I mean, that's the thing is now I was busy and now I was able to take on more.
But wait a minute. The addict in his game is the most incredible manipulator.
Yes.
So I'm pretty sure there was some manipulation going on about. Well, what do you think about maybe Adderall?
No, but listen, but her job is to know and spot that. You can't be a therapist and have that in your room and not know what it is when it comes at you.
Especially when I'm a cocaine addict.
Well, no, so, but my therapist, the therapists that work for me and with me and the ones that
I've had,
have a
therapist
the good ones,
and an addiction
the
person.
Good one would say, separate. I'm not a doctor. You would have to go see a fucking doctor.
Well, but by the way, that's even a worse idea, Bob. It's a worse idea. I'm sorry, but that's worse. But what you need
but
is
not
maybe
encourage, and now you have this therapeutic bond that is now being manipulated.
I got so good at manipulating.
There it is.
Well, so let me let me say this though: is that I went to take this with no ill will or no intention of abusing this. That didn't last.
Of course not.
It did not last long.
Yeah, but because the addict in you had the intention, but you as a person didn't have the intention. But the addict in you tricked the other you into thinking that maybe this is innocent. Well, no.
Well,
that's
really,
why we go to meetings so we can keep on track.
It's even better. It's even better. The addict him had heard it's long acting. Really, it's not as short as the cocaine. I will be able to use just the way it's prescribed.
But true,
like it's the same thing.
Real life was happening at this same time.
I know.
Jason became sewn at the hip.
I want to talk about
that.
And
I was along for the ride. Some of it's been a wonderful blessing. Some of it's been a disillusioning curse.
All right, we're going to talk about it. Hold on. We're going to take a break, and you're going to tell the story.
Okay.
All right, be right back after this.
All right.
Well, I think everyone's aware we just went through a terrible flu season, and allergy season coming up. Hydrolite. Stay ahead of your hydration. Quite simply, Hydrolite is the best oral rehydration product I've ever tried. Said it a million times. This is an exact product I intended to create because I knew we had a need for it. And these guys, apparently they own Australia and they brought it over here, and I can't say enough about it. My son just had a norovirus. He was extremely sick, and we literally avoided hospitalization by keeping him rehydrated with Hydrolite. So I am grateful to them. I understand what this is. This is, you know, this is the kind of replacement you need if you're dehydrated, if you're vomiting, if you have diarrhea, if you're working out hard, and just in daily in life, some people tend to not pay attention to staying hydrated, and this is the way to do so. It's more than water. You got to understand, water is one piece of hydration, but the solute, what's in the water, is what really gives you the volume replacement. So whether you're sick or not, you can absolutely benefit from proper balance of sodium, glucose, and water. Hydrolite does this better than sports drinks, or certainly better than water alone. Great flavors, orange, berry, lemonade. I, of course, like the fizzy tablets that you put in a bottle of water, and there you've got them. Hydrolite delivers up to 4 times your electrolytes with 75% less sugar. Solutions are appropriate for all ages, and each bottle or package includes easy-to-follow instructions. So you can find Hydrolite at Rite Aid or at Hydrolite.com/Dr. Drew, D-R-D-R-E-W. And for a limited time for our listeners, you can save 30% on Hydrolite. Just click on the banner on my website at drdrew.com and use the code DrDrew18, D-R-D-R-E-W-18 at checkout at Hydrolite.com/DRDREW and use the code DRDREW18 at checkout. Get that great discount. Heidler, you will not be disappointed, I promise. I want to welcome True Niagen to the show. True Niagen is a dietary supplement designed to boost key cellular resource called NAD. It's also, that's short for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. It's a coenzyme found in every living cell. It's essential to our cells, and it's a key mediator of metabolism. A lot of work being done in NAD these days. I've been watching it very carefully. The science is preliminary, but it's been looking good in a lot of areas. What's exciting about these studies is that the increased NAD levels may potentially help with cellular metabolism, regulating circadian rhythm, and they're even hopeful it may slow the effects of aging. Very interesting research, and seemingly no adverse effects. So while studies are very early, science out there is impressive. The biohacking community has gotten behind the research. Actually, the addiction treatment community has gotten behind it, too. I've been intrigued with the possibilities surrounding NAD and the research behind True Niagen. I suggest you check it out for yourself. Go to their website. In June, I had a chance to speak with the company's chief scientific advisor, Dr. Charles Brenner, on the Dr. Drew podcast. It was deep science, and it piqued my interest. In fact, I got on the product after talking to him. Definitely check out that episode. And to learn more about the research, the science, and the True Niagen supplements, visit TrueNiagen.com. That is TrueNiagen.com. Check it out today.
Oh, yeah. We're back.
All right. So you were going to talk about the journey.
The journey with Jason.
Journey with Jason.
It was a blessing. I still have a house in Laguna. I love Laguna. It's my favorite place. It's a way that clears my mind. It gets me out of my head. But we got involved in some business things, right? And I needed him to listen to me, but there was, do you know what I mean? That Adderall was just, that train was going.
Cruising.
Right?
Choo-choo.
And we had a talk in my courtyard, and I said, Jason, I think there's a way where we can do the right thing and just, like, hardly work and live here in Laguna and make good money. And he was like, no.
Oh, man.
Because I have, you know where the rehab we had was in Laguna on Cliff? I have an apartment I love 3 doors down. I could walk to work,
right,
and it would have been just perfect.
That's the beauty of Laguna.
Yeah. It's like a Christmas tree was going on up in there.
100%, man.
And we're going to have this place, and we're going to have this other place in Laguna, and then we're going to have. And I was like, but we'll probably make about the same amount of money if we just stayed home. And I kept encouraging you to have children so you would settle. You know what I mean? Children make you, like, want to be home more.
That is very true.
Right?
That is very true. One of the biggest gift is having my daughter. That makes things – you really learn the true meaning of life when you have kids.
Yeah. There's not much else to do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So anyways, I was witness to it, and I just felt like I'm not the guy to step in. We're too close. We're in business together. Somebody else is going to step in. And who did step in?
Well, at the end of this cycle, so I think it's important for people to know is as an addict in recovery – you know, taking the Adderall, it only took a couple weeks before I was taking 3 or 4 times the amount I was prescribed, and then I went up to 300 milligrams.
How much is that prescribed?
No,
you did.
How much is 300 milligrams?
It's a lot. What kind of were you? What was regular Adderall or just
regular? Yeah, well, and then but then my manipulation came, and then I started getting XR, and then I combined them. Right, so, but then that's what led into drinking because, you know, with all the knowledge I have around, you know, substance abuse and mental health and. You know, I go, I can't take a Xanax. I'll have a heart attack.
So oh my God. So think of that brain right there that thought of that. Right.
So I'm gonna drink alcohol. And so the drinking, that's the scariest thing is you have to remember, I was a guy that used to drink and I would get arrested. I mean, that was kind of just
sipping wine.
I was drinking straight vodka. So I would just pound it to go to sleep. And then I would just got in this cycle. And the scariest part is it went from one extreme – like not get arrested to interacting with very well educated doctors and people in this industry, and they couldn't tell. Right. That's the scariest thing that I think I went through. So what had happened, the straw that broke the camel's back is where I actually – and it wasn't like I was going out and partying. You have to understand, this time I was in my office isolated, miserable. I mean, it was the most suicidal – kind of component I've ever been in, but I could not escape this bondage. Hey,
everybody, watch Patrick Melrose, the TV show on Showtime. You saw it yet?
Yeah.
It explores exactly what you went through for a heroin addict, but who switched over to alcohol and what that feels like.
Well, and a lot of people, and I'm comfortable saying this today, is you have to understand 2 days before my daughter was born, I went into detox. And I went from the detox to the fourth floor, went up there. But I was so sick and so in the depths of my addiction that it wasn't but about a week until I went back out again, because I did not actively arrest the disease. I didn't get stabilized. And, you know, again, went on another run for a while. And then it got to the point where I was intervened on by my wife, because I had told her for so many years not to do anything. If she says anything, we're like basically threatening.
Yeah. Stay out of your disease?
Yeah, stay out of it. And I mean, it's nobody else's business, you know, and she didn't know what to do. And
can we stop right there for 1 second? This happens a lot with treatment professionals because your livelihood is based on your sobriety.
Oh, yeah.
And I've helped a lot of people. We just talked about a woman that we helped that had this problem today.
A very good therapist.
We love this woman, and I confronted her, right? It did not go well. Part of another reason why I didn't confront.
Well, it's the same thing with being a pastor. You know, you could have a mortgage broker, you could be an attorney, you could be even a doctor, and you slip and have a fall, whether it's immorality, adultery,
you
whatever.
You
still have your job. Right. As a pastor or a treatment professional, you're done.
That goes back to what you were saying in the beginning, though. I was in such a disease of denial. Like, I mean, that's, I look at addiction as a disease of denial, and to know how much I was suffering and knowing everything I knew, I still couldn't reach out. That's what's scary about
that.
That's
so painful.
It's the worst. And I think that's why today, like when Pete said, we're looking at, you know, because with how corrupt the treatment industry is, like I always will be an ambassador because I've had a taste of recovery. I always love truly what that is today. But I honestly think this is the best thing that happened, is because my marriage is the best it's ever been. My relationships are the closest they've ever been. Like with Bob, you know, and that's like, it's almost making amends in a public format, is because the best of my decision kept getting me back to where I was.
Well, the three of us know that it just takes what it takes. So you're not going to scare us away. You know what I mean? No matter what happens to you. Wouldn't you say?
I would say, absolutely.
We know it takes what it takes.
Jason probably felt abandoned by me, and it was a conscious decision. Like, I'm not the guy that should be doing this.
That's not him being scared away.
Right.
That's him taking a stand.
It was me just taking a step back. And you know where I live.
Yeah.
You never came by one time.
Yeah. I was too busy taking apart a shredder.
You know those shredders, you got to see what goes on inside them, Drew.
Well, dude, when you put 500 pieces of paper in there and it gets jammed, I'm over there with a benchmark knife cranking through it, and before you know it,
for all you non-addicts at home, that's called tweaking.
Tweaking. Stimulus. Take your TV, your radio, your refrigerator.
First time I've heard of shredder.
What's so funny, the cops, I was talking to cops today, and they go, you know, we're out in the street. Why do they keep taking their bikes apart? They keep their bikes apart. That's meth, dude. That's just meth.
Oh, my God. Oh, gosh. So anyways, I'm so glad. I knew that it would happen. I knew that everything would – because you know the fundamentals of it. I think Jason was a victim of the Orange County rehab world, and I now have been down there for 3 years. You grew up there. You know. The L.A. world, I'm not saying it's perfect. It just has a certain amount of ethics that just don't exist 35 miles south.
Right.
I don't understand.
Or 3,000 miles east.
Let's put it this way. We have a spectrum of ethics up here that includes some good folks. I think the spectrum is narrower down there and skewed the wrong way.
Let's just get to the pink elephant in the room. Patient brokering doesn't really happen in Los Angeles.
Oh, is that true?
It's invented in Orange County.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how.
Inherited from Florida.
Yes,
really?
That's right.
How did it become so acceptable? Like, hey, whoa. And Jason never struck me as that. Jason's a guy that invests far too much time with one client, like 5 hours with this one guy, the big guy at the Newport Beach.
Yep.
I told Jason, if you don't mind and get this guy, pick him up. I just talked to him for a couple hours. He was going to go. Yeah, sleep apnea. Jason lives over there for 2 days. Like,
yeah, dude, he even got the guy a damn PAP machine or whatever it was for his
CPAP. Yeah, CPAP machine. I used one of those.
Got off of freaking Craigslist. I was like, Bob, who the hell did you set me up with?
Dude, he was ready to get in the car. And somehow Jason's just like loving people too much. Patient brokering doesn't fit a soul like that.
Oh,
though he's in the middle of that world.
Any soul that's living a good life, it doesn't fit with number one. Number two, so eventually we'll do a little love and codependency work with Jason.
Yeah.
Not yet. Too soon. but you'll need that too.
For sure. Well, it's funny you say that because I did a people-pleasing test of 30 characteristics that show...
You're 28 of 30?
27 of 30. Okay. So that became very apparent. But the biggest thing that I always want to advocate, and the reason why I came out with this and the reason why I'm so content and present today is because, honestly, the way I was living and the thing I had again... I think I said this on your first podcast I ever did years ago, is I grew up in a very stable, functioning, unbelievable family. But then again, when I went into the entertainment business, experienced some notoriety, some, you know, money, all this different shit.
Let me tell you something. There's no difference between the entertainment industry and the recovery industry you were involved in.
That's what
it's all grandiose and big shotism.
Correct.
Right?
So that's what I was alluding to is one, I was not happy doing what I was doing. I was in the beginning. But I became very unhappy again, and I think that's the biggest thing is I wanted to let people know is by me coming out is one, this does happen, but two is do not suffer anymore. I mean, that's the thing. 3 years of suffering, you don't need to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know.
Well, you're not the only one down there that's gone through this, and I think you all need to rise up and start a real ethical, honorable kind of treatment center that's transparent. I'd like to be a part of it. I look at that condo every time I drive. I was there on Friday, Thursday and Friday. I think, what the fuck? This is the most beautiful idea. The Jason family owns this property. We put a 12-bed rehab in there. It was so beautiful an idea, and it just went to hell because it was a part of the Orange County scum.
It fed on – now, the three of – we're going to pretend like you're not here for a second.
Okay. Oh, man.
It's not going to be bad because we love you and we like everything about you. But there's a piece of his character that is an addict piece that flourishes in all that, that still is attached to him.
Yeah.
Okay? That piece, he's got something. His program's got to release that or manage it.
He needs to delete some software and then put some new stuff in there.
Maybe, because he'll always be the same guy, you know. But there's a part of it. There's a part he's not really aware of it. I see it.
I know.
But you know, I know Pete knows what I'm talking about because you probably had to let go of the same stuff, right, in order to flourish, in order to get well. I don't know. We got to get him there.
Well, in your case, gravitating towards the head of the Vagos and those guys, looking up to those guys. Instead of, I met all the people he was looking up to, and I was repulsed by them. Right?
Right.
You have to get a little more antisocial personality. Jason.
He's got that. Right? You don't have that. You don't have that.
Yeah.
Right? I don't have that. Maybe I do. But you don't have that. I just keep using the words, Pete, for him, humility and gratitude, humility and gratitude. It's like that's sort of where the road, the humility and gratitude road is the road where he needs to be.
I think the contagious nature of that narcissistic the vein that seems to run through our
culture. You know all the people we're talking about.
Right, I do. Yeah. And so I think the contagious part of that has attempted to infect Jason, but because of his heart.
I don't think it's that. I think they're using
the
him
because
he's being used because
it
he's so
him.
Genuine and authentic and caring. Using him, and then he's buying their bullshit.
But I'm going to tell you.
And there was no way I could stop
But Bob, the part
he,
that's
buying,
the part that buys the bullshit is his addict self. There's a part of him that kind of is attracted to that BS.
It's instant gratification. Because that's what happened, though, is, like I said, things were good. The complacency, I started surrounding me. You're a product of your environment. I always say that. And my own chaos surrounded me with those people, not you.
Yeah, yeah.
Those people became in. But you're absolutely right. That's the biggest thing I need to focus on, that I believe.
I'm not worried you're going to get rid of those people. I want that part of you.
I know what you're talking about.
I don't know for sure either.
Well,
he's moved to Irvine.
That's humbling.
But it's not strictly humility.
Wait, Drew, you got to understand this. He lived in a beautiful house. It was nice. It fit them. Right?
Yes, yes.
Then he sells it because he's making a good amount of money off of housing sales. It was close to my house. It was cool. He then tells me he's got a new house, and I'm thinking it's going to be something humble. It's like near the ocean in the most expensive part of Orange County. I'm like, Jason,
never
how the fuck
me
can
there.
You
I would come
afford
visit.
This?
Right? Yeah.
It was two people living in like a 15-room house.
Hey, dude, somebody had to do it. I was saying, I wanted to paint
it's
a lot
that.
Of rooms.
It's that.
It's that, but it's... We don't know what it really is yet. We'll see it. As you go along your recovery, it will sort of present itself.
I believe he doesn't know how much we love him.
I know that.
I don't care where he lives.
Yeah.
I don't care. Actually, I don't like the bigger houses.
So I don't know. You know, probably for Jason, I can only, so for me, walking into a room and having or a bar, even as a sober person, you know, walking into a bar and having everybody say, "Oh, there's Freeway Pete, National Sergeant Arms of the Vagos." Shh, you know, pay him respect. That was elevating for me. You know, and now
it can't matter though. It can't matter.
No, it can't. But it did. It did, yeah. Because it massaged all of that angst I had as a result of, you know, growing up and feeling invisible and disqualified.
Right.
But then now, like, the same amount of recognition when I walk and say, "Oh, that's Pastor Pete. Did you see him on?" And like now it's like, "Oh man, I hope I'm not seen doing anything, you know,
shady,
right? You know what I mean?" Because the whole desire for the image, it still exists. Like, I know Jason still has when we walk into a PA meeting and that's Jason Waller. Remember, he was on the hills. Mm-hmm. And that's got to be gratifying to some extent because you did put in a lot of work and you were good at it. But then there's that part that says, okay, so now how do I exemplify being right-sized and humble when I'm being recognized in a public venue?
It's a fine line.
My thing is, it can't matter.
Right.
If it matters, then that piece is active again.
So I have a question for you guys then, especially with that stuff, because I think a lot of that was a controversy to where I ended up personally because I didn't know how to deal with it. Now I feel like I have better resources to do that, but there's been an opportunity for potentially to go back on to these things. And that's where I can say something's changed because I didn't jump to do it, but we're actually in the process of thinking of doing something. But that's where if I'm feeling uncomfortable, what is that a sign of?
That's a good sign.
It's a good sign. That's a good sign. Contemplating it. So I live in that world, and what I've found is I have good, solid friends. You mentioned some of them.
Mm-hmm.
They keep me right-sized, right? They, you know, I'm the guy, anytime there's a question about recovery in our home group on Thursday nights, like, "I don't know, ask Bob. He's the one that knows everything about everything."
Right. Yeah.
And it just makes me embarrassed. Like, no, I don't know everything about everything.
That's something that's huge that you just brought up, though, is going into those and not pretending like I know everything anymore. It's going in there and just listening.
Humble. Humility is key.
Well, but you don't want to be the king of humility. It's so grandiose.
Right. That's almost an ego trip in itself, right?
Well, that's interesting. I'd not thought that. You're right.
You know what I mean?
Humble I am.
Well, the codependent flips into a grandiosity. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a fine line, and it's really hard to walk a public sober. I think it's why Bill Wilson was so depressed. I mean, imagine what it was like to be him. He was suicidally depressed. You know, he had a lot of mistresses, apparently. So here he is, this inventor of this life-changing program, and he knows he's not all that, but then he is that. Like, I just think I just look to the founder who started the thing that I'm a part of.
He's still an alcoholic. Yeah. That's the bottom line. He was still an alcoholic.
But how did he walk that line?
He defined the target.
Yeah.
He didn't say he'd arrive. He could find the target. Yeah. It's like the Apostle Paul, writer of two-thirds of the New Testament.
Yes.
In Romans chapter 6, he talks about, why is it that I can't do the things that I want to do and I'm still stuck doing the things that I don't want to do? Who will save me from this body of sin? And I thank God for Jesus Christ, my Lord and Savior, because we are none of us capable of walking the line that we aspire to walk. It's like there's humanity involved. We've got the human problem. And so in that, I think Jung, you know, talks about, you know, the shadow self. And, you know, we have the self that we would love to be, the target self, the person who we'd espouse to be, or the person that I preach about, you know, wanting to become on Sunday morning. But then there's this other part of me that's a little dark, you know. I got a dark side. And how do we find the balance in that? And how do we find the way to not condemn ourselves for our humanity and still aspire to live in this lofty place?
And this is why I think community is so important. I'm either going to hang out with people who reinforce my darkness reinforce my aspirations.
Exactly. I have a question for you, too.
Right.
What are we going to do when Jason gets tongue and mouth cancer from chew?
Jesus Christ. The kid's
his head.
He's getting off of drugs again, Drew. Can you give him a break?
Just make sure we're all okay with that.
Sorry, guys. Not perfect.
Dude, make sure we're all cool with that. That's all.
God. Don't worry. He tells me about my liver cancer from hepatitis C all the time.
Okay,
I used to before you got it treated.
Yeah, Harvoni, the miracle drug.
You look good, man.
That works for you.
Yeah, it worked for him. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Have you? Were you ever afflicted?
I was exposed to, this is a crazy story, man. I was exposed to Hep C. They started me on that old school medication.
Oh, right.
I went to my pastor and I said, you know, I've been diagnosed with Hep C. And he said, I want you to come in and I want this guy, Howard, to pray for you. And this guy came in and they laid me out on the desk and they prayed for me. And for 3 days, I was sick as a dog. My liver felt like a cinder block.
With the interferon?
Feverish. I had only done the interferon 3 days.
Oh, and, makes you so sick.
And so then, I woke up on the fourth morning. I felt like a gazelle. You know, yeah. I felt like a teenager again.
And so
I
went back to the doctor. You had a great response.
I went back to the doctor, and he said, "You need to stop taking that medication right away because."
Why?
Because
it makes you sick. It makes you
no.
Very
but
sick.
What happened was I got healed. Yeah. You know, basically, and I've relapsed since then. And I thought, oh man, God's going to give me my Hep C back for sure. But you know, and I still get tested every 6 months to a year, and I have a no genotype, no viral count, load count.
Great.
None of that. But I have a young friend, one of my best friend's sons, who works in the recovery deal. He's a sober coach and works around L.A., young, beautiful, vital young man. And he has had a myriad of physical health problems. Like, I had ulcerative colitis, and they took my colon out and half my small intestine. All that. But this young man was going bad with this colitis, and then he had Hep C. And so he just finished the Harbone deal, and he was completely cured.
Yeah. Do you have a Coke's pouch or something? What'd they make for you?
I have a J-pouch.
J-pouch, yeah.
Yeah.
Now we're getting into Dr. Drew territory.
Yeah,
we're talking about mouth and throat cancer,
machine.
Liver cancer, pouches.
It's time for education.
And I had the Pristol procedure done on my pancreas as well. So.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's time to close it up when we're doing doctor talk.
Yeah,
this is his own doctor talk show now.
Jason's been sort of coyly out of our focus. Are we good? Are you good?
I'm
golden. Do you hear more from us?
Yeah. No, this is good.
You want to tell more about your story or anything? We didn't answer whether you should do this thing coming up.
Yeah, no, I wanted to come up here to connect and see you guys. Yeah. I know, you know.
This is just the first.
I know. Let me tell you, I told him fine, as long as sponsor and people in his sober.
He knows how to say, hang around with this guy instead of the people you were hanging around, right?
Yeah.
It's that simple.
I got to say something about Jason. I think really at the end of the day, one of the reasons that he came up here today was to help me, you know, to support me. And because he knows I really wanted to connect with you guys.
We appreciate. First of all, I want to read the book, number one.
Dead Man Waking,
number one. Number two, I appreciate you watching after him. So we're part of the team now. So
yeah.
I needed to meet you.
Yeah. Okay, great. That's awesome.
So good.
Awesome.
All right, Bob, we good?
All right, we're good. I got to go pick an Elvis
Golda.
Up.
All right, man. Anyone shout out any of your stuff, your Twitter handles or anything? Did we get all that out there?
Well, Instagram is the main one for me, but that's just at Jason Waller. Do a little bit of.
I would think Snapchat at your age.
No, bro.
That's 14 year olds.
Yeah, come on, Bob. A couple years older than that.
All right, so for me, if I might say, deadmanwaking.net. You can look into my books at deadmanwaking.net.
Great. Congratulations, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Great day. See ya.
All right, that's about it for this episode of This Life. Check us out at KBC, being Lawrence Avon, 790 Midday Live Talk Radio, Monday to Friday. You can also tune in every day live via the magic of the internet at kbc.com. If you miss it, we've made it simple for you to find all the shows at drdrew.com, the Adam and Dr. Drew podcast, the Sing One I Do By Myself, Dr. Drew podcast, This Life, of course, with Bob Swole Patrol, Mike Cantho, at his new health and fitness podcast. You can find us on Twitter at This Life Podcast, at Dr. Drew, D-R-E-W, at Rehab Bob Forrest, and of course, our lovely producer at First Lady of Love. I think I know who that is. If you love this show, please subscribe and tell a friend. We appreciate it when you do. We'd love to hear your feedback as well. Send us a message. Join the email list at drdrew.com, drdrew.com/contact. You'll also get a weekly email from us on that. While you're at it, at doctor.com, please support our sponsors by clicking through the banners. We only advertise products that I can get behind. So thank you for supporting them, those that support us. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.